You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at the 2018 Tour de France in association with Rafa. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee shops, Rafa exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport. Today, we're in Quimper.
Where are we, Lionel?
We're outside a bar in Châteauland, where the Tour de France passed through a little bit earlier on this afternoon on its way to Quimper.
And we'll hear a little bit about Quimper in the final, rather surreal part of tonight's podcast. We caught up with Daniel Freeb earlier on, and he joins us for a bit of, well, discussion about cycling, horse racing,
fishing,
football. Oh. Covered
and
a lot
orange things and intravenous injections.
The final part is probably not to everybody's taste, but carry on listening if you want to hear that. We've got a lot to pack in before then. Lionel's in a bit of a hurry. Well, let's just crack on, Lionel. Give us a tale of the etap, please.
I will. Stage 5 of the Tour de France from
Lorient.
From Lorient, of course.
And not Leighton Orient.
No, not Leighton Orient. From Lorient in Brittany to Quimper in Brittany. It was the first testy uphill finish. Testy stage all round, really. A lot of climbing. As Mark Cavendish said at the finish, there was really not a metre of flat. It was either up or down. The break today included, 7 men got away. Lilian Calmejean and Sylvain Chavanel of Direct Energy. Jasper de Boist of Lotto Soudal, Michel Vermot of Dimension Data, Tom Schoens of...
Hang on, Michel Vermot, he was he won the Tour of Britain in about 1989, did he not?
Yeah.
Julien Vermot.
Wow. Didn't expect to see him in this Tour de France.
55-year-old Michel Vermot. No, it was Julien Vermot of Dimension Data. Sorry about that. Tom Schoens of Trek Segafredo. Elie Gesbert of Fortuneo. And Nicolas Hedet of Cofidis.
Michel Vermot is 55. I just looked it up.
What a great guess. Anyway, with about 100 kilometres to go, just inside 100 kilometres to go, Sylvain Chavanel went away on his own. And that really broke up the group. And then a leading quartet of Calmejean, Chavanel, Hedet and Schoens were the last out in front, and it split on the climbs. Calmejean and Schoens were by far the stronger of the rest of the group. Tom Schoens collected enough points to take the King of the Mountains jersey, but they were caught on the Côte de la Chapelle de la Lorette, not far from the finish. And then after that, Ryan Talame of Direct Energy went clear with about 10 kilometres to go. He was also caught with around 5.5 to go. And then in the final kilometre, Philippe Gilbert went for a very, very long one, probably not to win the stage, but maybe to soften things up for Julien Alaphilippe. He was followed by Julien Simon of Cofidis, who had won the Tour du Finistère, a one-day race in this region that finishes on that same final climb. But then when it came down to the line, well, Richard, you tweeted a picture of Sagan written all across the road.
I didn't, actually. I just said that it had him written all over it. Someone tweeted me the picture back.
Ah, sorry. Well, that shows how much I was paying attention to Twitter this afternoon. But Sagan's name was written all over this finish, and he won his second stage of the Tour. Sonny Colbrelli, very close again for Bahrain Merida, and Gilbert hung on for third. So Greg Van Avermaet keeps the yellow jersey ahead of his teammate TJ Van Garderen. Peter Sagan stretches his lead in the green jersey. Tom Schoens is level with Chavanel on 4 points in the King of the Mountains, but he will wear the polka dot jersey tomorrow, and Soren Krau Andersen is in the white jersey still.
Correct.
Just a few riders to mention who crashed out or pulled out. Michael Matthews didn't start today. He was sick overnight, so he would have been really a favourite for today and tomorrow, the Sunweb rider, but he's already out of the Tour. Robert Kieselowski of Katusha crashed very early in the stage in the first couple of kilometres, and he pulled out. And Tish Benoot of Lotto Soudal, who crashed very hard yesterday, is also out of the Tour.
Live corrections corner. It's Michel Darnis won the Tour, the Kellogg's Tour, not Michel Vermot.
But I was wrong about Michel Vermot, Julien Vermot, of course.
Yeah, a contest of boo-boos, but there we are.
A community around the world, stories and films with the most compelling characters, the world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Yes, thank you very much to our headline sponsor, Rafa. They've just published a book called Carte de Tour. It's a beautiful book featuring old maps, or old and new maps of the Tour de France, by Paul Fresnel, who's a very respected writer in France. I met him at the Rafa Cycle Club in London just before the tour got underway, and that chat I had with him features in tomorrow's episode of Kilometer Zero, which is out tomorrow morning. Today was the Adam Hansen story. You met up with him, Lionel. It's a brilliant listen. Really enjoyed that. If you haven't had a chance to catch up on that yet, I highly recommend it. Today's stage, then, it was an exciting one. I think a really engrossing stage. We've had a couple of pretty boring ones, but this was really, you couldn't take your eyes off this one. And one of the intriguing things about it was we saw Lilian Calmejean, a rider who excels in these hard kind of stages and has won stages and Grand Tours before, up the road. And he was with Tom Schoenge, who looked very good indeed. And I met him as I was walking back to the press centre after the stage. He was wearing his King of the Mountains jersey. He was following someone. I don't know where he was going, actually. But as he walked wherever he was going, I walked alongside him and asked him about a little argument that seemed to be raging between him and Calmejean during the stage. Here's what he said. Thomas, what happened out there? You were exchanging a few words with Calmejean, it looked like.
Yeah.
What was the beef?
He wanted us to, let's follow this guy. He wanted us to ride really hard because he was sitting on for 30K and then he was feeling that we were not riding hard enough. So he was very excited to hit the wind.
You looked very sprightly, very strong. You felt good out there, I take it.
Yeah, definitely felt good. Fighting against Calmejean, he's a really, really good rider. He's won stages in the Tour. He's won a stage in the Vuelta, I believe. He's gotten one over me in Italy, so it was nice to get one over him here.
And in your first Tour, that must have felt good being at the front of the race.
Yes, it definitely did, and it was good fun, especially on a day like today when there's pretty hectic, you know. I heard after I got caught and got dropped, I heard that there were some crashes, unfortunately. But that's the name of the game sometimes here, from what I've also heard.
Yeah, so I had a chance to talk to Lilian Calmejean myself, where at his bus when, after the stage, and he was really... There's no other word, you know, sorry, dear listeners. He was really pissed off about the day's stage. Because, as you said, we started with Sylvain Chavanel, who went into the break to try and win the stage. We had no plans whatsoever to, you know, grapple a few points for the polka dot jersey. That's not the way we race. We had no intentions on getting the Prix de la Combativité or for the most aggressive rider. We didn't plan anything like that. We really wanted to win the stage. Then Rein Taramae, also a direct energy rider, went for the stage. Really, the problem, he said, was that, you know, in that break you can't win. You can't take a break all the way if the riders in the break don't actually want to win the stage. And his impression was that everybody was making their own calculations. The Trek riders going for the polka dot jersey, even Nicolas Hédé of Cofidis was also in this break. Others were content with getting all these bonus little jerseys or prizes of the day. Whereas actually he was going for the stage win. So he was really frustrated, said, he was playing cat and mouse with Stones. He had really had the impression the guy was taking no turns, just waiting for the, you know, every KOM hill to take a few points away from them. And at the end of the day, Team Direct Energy finished without anything. They didn't take the jersey. They didn't win the stage. They didn't even have the most aggressive rider prize. He went to Stoj as well. And Calmejean said, if this guy is aggressive, you know, what am I? I don't understand the meaning of the word. So, yeah, a real little argument inside a break, that's rather interesting. interesting to see that it's not always, you know, guys working together to in order to achieve some goals. It's most of the time, or some of the time,
yeah,
you know, real quarrel inside the break.
But it's a bit like the beef that Quickstep had yesterday, you know, upset that other teams wouldn't help the chase. I mean, Calmejean can be as upset as he likes, but if Scoyne's target is to sprint to win the King of the Mountains points, well, that's life. I mean, this is the fascinating things that play out on the road. What I would say about Calmejean is he is a classy rider. He won at Station de Russe last year, really impressive. Do you remember he almost kind of ground to a halt at one point on that climb and gathered himself for a second wind to push on because he had quite a good time advantage, and he won that stage very impressively. It struck both of us, Francois, with two ascents of the Mer de Bretagne tomorrow, a bit of a waste of energy for Calmejean today.
He said he finished absolutely exhausted because he said, actually, out of frustration in the finale, he said, I gave it my all. I really wanted to finish dead, you know, just to prove myself that I'd done my best. And in my opinion, the opinion of others, you know, including David Godu, who is the local rider, you know, we'll talk about him later. He really, you know, Calmejean as one of the guys to watch tomorrow. But unfortunately, Calmejean himself said he worked so hard today that there's no way he's going to win tomorrow, which would have been a better stage actually for him. And he said he would probably wait for the mountains to try another kind of, you know, the same sort of attempt he did last year in Leroux, and it worked that time.
Well, at the finish, I saw Dan Martin warming down on his rollers outside the Team UAE Emirates bus, and I grabbed a quick word with him. I also asked one of the most stupid questions I've ever asked. I asked him whether...
Stiff competition there,
stiff competition, yeah. We could possibly have top 10 most stupid questions I've ever asked. Are we going to play this just to prove that, you know, I'm fallible like the rest of you?
I think maybe you do it on purpose, you know? It's a kind of a... like the guys in the break, you're going for your own prize.
You know. But no, I was kind of... It's funny, isn't it? I mean, you go to the buses at the finish and you see all of chaos of the riders coming in the team cars. You see the riders darting between the cars to get back to their bus. And then Dan Martin was just on the rollers on his own, just tucked away behind the bus next to a tree. And I thought, well, I'll go and have a chat. But you don't have time in your mind to think, right, what's the five questions I want to ask Dan Martin? So I asked him...
This is a really nice way to introduce the most stupid question you've ever asked.
The other questions weren't quite so stupid, no. But the stupid question comes in the middle when I asked him whether the Mer de Bretagne climb is in any way comparable to the Mer de Huy, which, of course, Dan Martin has done very well on in the past at Flèche Wallonne and almost has won on Flèche Wallonne. He's almost won at the Mer de Bretagne as well. So this is what he said anyway. Dan, is it fair to say that today was a good finish for you, but tomorrow suits you probably much better?
Yeah, I was just staying out of trouble today, you know, and I'm a bit surprised that my sprinting legs are that good. It's been a while since I did that type of finish, but yeah, we'll see tomorrow. I mean, these great days are so stressful and so crazy that you actually have to get to the finish line, you know, so yeah, I'm sure it's going to be a very hard day again tomorrow, but yeah, I'm really happy with how I felt today.
Yesterday you had a small crash, I think, 50 kilometres to go, or you were caught up in it?
No, not really. You know, the one with 5k to go, I was kind of like just on the side of it and had to stop, but yeah, no problem at all.
Do you feel like the peloton's settling down a little bit more with stages like today? Is the stress easing a little bit at all?
It's hard to say. I mean, I think everybody's realised that there's too many crashes going on, so maybe everybody's given a little bit more attention, but also everybody's a little bit more attention, but it's also I think when there's crashes it breeds more crashes because guys are like so afraid of crashing that they the slightest hint that there might be something happening they grab the brakes, and that it's overreactions that also always cause crashes as well, you know, so it's a vicious circle. And also obviously with the crashes everybody's more scared and wants to be at the front more, so it's a vicious circle.
So making the peloton that little bit smaller, it hasn't really had much of an effect on the way people are racing?
I think it has. You know, obviously it's always going to race the same. I don't know why we all change the way we race at the Tour. I don't, but everybody else seems to, you know, and it's like I've seen more crashes in these first 4 days than I have in the whole year, but it's, I think it's made it safer, you know, because there's 25 less guys fighting for the front, so It's a lot easier to navigate around the peloton. It's a lot easier to find your teammates, and obviously it's not a huge difference, but it is a difference.
What do you think of the Mur de Bretagne? What's it similar to? Is it like a kind of a mini Mur de Huy?
No, not at all. It's a completely different climb, you know. It's big road, straight. It's more like Côte d'Anse more than anything, I think, because you look up and you can see the top, and that hurts, guys. And it's, just goes straight up in front of your face, you know. So I've only done it that once. It's a bittersweet memory for me because, obviously, second, a great result, but I really feel I should have won that day. So we'll try and do our best tomorrow.
And lastly, looking ahead at the cobbles, and you've just been talking about crashes, I mean, how do you feel about Sunday's stage and what's ahead of you, 15 sections of cobbles?
Again, I kind of don't know what to think. In isolation, I think I'm looking forward to it slightly because I'm never going to ride Paris-Roubaix, you know, and what an experience to say you've raced over the cobblestones of Paris-Roubaix, but at the same time, it's like, I just hope it is the legs and the cobblestones that decide the race and none of the GC contenders lose the race because of a mechanical or a crash, because you don't want the race to be decided because of bad luck, you know.
Well, thank you to Dan Martin for not making me feel twice the idiot that I already felt. I knew the climb at Mur de Bretagne, I mean, it's the name of the town as well, isn't it? So it's not just the name of the climb, but it's absolutely dead straight, isn't it? And you can see it from a long, long way away. I've actually ridden it a couple of times, it's hard. It's a hard finish.
It's an interesting one about it. I mean, to go about a little, you know, local details. Actually, the town is called Mur de Bretagne, which means Wall of Brittany. But actually, so the Mur de Bretagne should be called le Mur de Mur de Bretagne. It should be called the Wall of Brittany. But you know, they turn it into le Mur de Bretagne, and they even kind of pretend now that the town is named after the hill, which is not the case at all.
And Francois, you spoke to local rider David Godou, yes, who is one of the youngest riders in the Tour, riding for Groupama FTJ, a very promising young rider. I don't think you've spoken to him before. Did you have to wait for him long outside his team
waiting
bus?
For Godou? Yeah, well, I mean, we knew that Richard Moore couldn't miss that. I mean, I actually had to wait for a little bit for him because he was at the briefing before it came, started to chat with him a little bit, and then of course a lot of other local journalists came because he is from Quimper originally, so he was really the local writer today. He had very interesting little things to say about the way he tackled his first tour, because he's a very he won the Tour de l'Avenir a couple of years back. He showed real, you know, gusto and you know, aggressivity in his first professional races. So he's really one of the, well, and we've said it before on the podcast, he's one of the greatest hopes of French cycling, probably one of the greatest hopes as a potential Grand Tour winner in the future. But he knows Mur de Bretagne very well. He said he said something very funny. He said, I live 40 k's away from Mur de Bretagne, but I don't go and train on it because it's boring. You know, he said, without the race around, when you just get there, there's nothing, there's no one, just there's long stretch going up, and it's not very funny. So I'd rather train on other places. But it's kind of completely transfigured on race day when it's all of a sudden with all these people, it's something else. So he compared it to Mur de Huy as well at the Flèche Wallonne, saying it was not as difficult. He said that there's really an opportunity tomorrow for bold riders because the Mur de Bretagne will be climbed twice in that stage. He said there's really an opportunity for bold riders to attack in the first ascent to try to, you know, take the best over the favourites on this type of effort.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. You can get 25% off all your Science in Sport products at scienceinsport.com with the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25. We haven't spoken much about today's winner, Peter Sagan. I mean, what else is there to say about Sagan? He is an extraordinary bike rider. And when we came through the finish, it's a sort of halfway house between a sprint and a hilltop finish. It was a little bit like the finish last year in, remind me, Lionel, the day before La Planche des Belles Filles in Longwy. Longwy. Mm.
Yeah,
not too hard, not too selective. Before, yeah. That was a stage for Van Avermaet, Matthews, Sagan. Today was very similar, and we saw Sagan up there with one or two of the main contenders. Tom Dumoulin was very prominent. Vincenzo Nibali was very prominent. Mm. Chris Froome was very prominent. Team Sky really led it in the last few kilometres, really took it on at the front. I actually spoke to Nicolas Portal, their sports director at the finish, and asked him what the thinking had been. At one point, I wondered whether they were setting up for Michał Kwiatkowski, who could also have done well
logical.
There. But then Kwiatkowski himself took it on at the front, so clearly not. They were just keeping Froome out of trouble. They recognised it could be a dangerous finish. I wondered if in the back of their minds they wondered whether Geraint Thomas, whether, you know, Van Avermaet might be too hard for him and Geraint Thomas may get the yellow jersey, but I don't really know why Sky would necessarily want that.
No, I mean,
they were keeping out of trouble. Egan Bernal looked very good. Lionel's been telling me off for mentioning him too many times, but he did look very good, Egan Bernal.
The thing about Sagan is he's won today and he could win again tomorrow quite easily. I was looking at the results. The last time the Tour was at Mur de Bretagne in 2015, the top 10 are all here in this race. Alexis Riemers of AG2R won last time. You'd have to think he's part of the Bardet support.
He could have his day tomorrow.
Could have his day.
I'm pretty sure.
Tony Gallopin was fifth that day as well, but for Lotto Soudal then, he's now with AG2R as well. So Dan Martin was second. Alejandro Valverde was third. Sagan fourth. Greg Van Avermaet sixth. Adam Yates seventh. Chris Froome eighth. Malcolm Ollmer ninth. TJ Van Garder in tenth. I mean, that you could look at that result
I'd go for Valverde tomorrow because Movistar have been very quiet. They've been waiting for that moment to come. Valverde is out for not only revenge, but you know, he's like Sagan. If he has a chance, he's not going to miss it. It's a little bit too hard for Sagan tomorrow, I think, in terms of the of two ascents of the multiple times. Yeah. It's maybe a little bit too much for Sagan. But I agree 100%. Today, what we saw, I mean, when you have Philippe Gilbert, the former world champion, and we know the record of Philippe Gilbert attacking, then you had Greg Van Avermaet, probably the best with Sagan, one day race, classic rider, Olympic champion, attacking in turn, and it's useless and is a gear that there's still a gear left for Sagan to beat these guys. It says it all. Is really really the best in this kind of efforts.
What's fascinating about these classics type finishes, and we'll probably see the same again on Sunday with the cobbles, is that you have the classics type dimension, but without the all or nothing racing of the classics, because everyone has in their mind whether tomorrow is another day. We have a longer term objective. You might tease out some of the GC riders tomorrow, but will they give everything? Will they ride within themselves? And then you have riders that will say, that's my day. I'm going to absolutely lay everything on the line. And so you have this whole conflict of interests, really, that you don't necessarily get in the classics, because in the classics it's like, well, it's all or nothing today. There's not the same level of kind of ducking and diving and secondary or even primary focuses that come into play in terms of the way they're thinking.
Marc Madiot told me a very interesting thing today. We'll hear it maybe in a future Kilometre Zero, but he said, I think it sums it up. He said, the Grand Tours are the rare opportunities during the season when two populations of riders meet up, the climbers and the classic riders. And obviously, they have conflict, there's a conflict of interest there. But it's the only time in the season when these two populations are at the same race, on the same courses, at the same time. And that's why sometimes it's a little bit confusing.
Well, a guy who was really impressive, it was Sonny Colbrelli, who finished second. I mentioned Vincenzo Nibali already. Barry Morita came to the front as well in numbers to keep Nibali out of trouble, but also to set up Colbrelli. And Colbrelli, it was, I mean, Sagan, he made Sagan work hard for that win. It was, they were head to head. He did everything right. Well, I asked Brent Copeland about that, the general manager at Barry Morita. Asked him about Colbrelli and about Nibali. Here's what he had to say.
I mean, Sagan is a very difficult man to beat on a finish like that, but Sonny Colbrelli pushed him really close.
Yeah, Sonny's been working a lot on these kind of finishes, and we've been working a lot with him. He's got to the Tour in top condition lighter than he's ever been before, so we knew these kind of finishes would suit him, but to beat Sagan is never easy. So you could see today he pushed himself to the limit. He was on par with him with about 50 meters to go, and then his legs just opened up.
Well, watching it, I'm sure you were studying it closely. It didn't look like he really did anything wrong. It was ended up a sort of drag race between the pair of them. Watching it, was there anything else he could have done differently to try and beat him?
No, nothing. We've analysed the race, and we looked at it with the other guys and spoke to other riders, and they raced perfectly. Main priority was to look after Vincenzo, which they did really well. He was sitting on Sonny's wheel in the last few hundred metres, so that was all under control. And then the race, he had the opportunity to race for himself. So, there was nothing more he could do than what he did. It just came down to him and Sagan, and Sagan was the better man.
I was going to ask you about Nibali as well, because we saw a few of the GC guys at the front that finished. Dumoulin, Froome was there, and Nibali was very prominent. Is that a sign of the sort of form that he's in?
These stages are always nervous stages for everyone, and it's stages where you can lose time. You're not going to gain time, but you can lose. So he had to race up front and make sure that he was out of trouble, and that's what he did all day. But it's easy to do that in theory. You've got to put it in practice, and to put it into practice, you've got to have the good condition. So seeing where the way he is racing today shows that his condition's good. For these kind of stages, we've got to see when we go into the mountains what it's like.
I mean, there's a sort of idea about Nibali that he's a guy who tends to get better in the third week, certainly. And, we saw him dropped on early in the Vuelta last year. He came back and won the stage into Andorra. But I remember up in this neck of the woods, the stage finished tomorrow, in fact, he lost time a few years ago when the Tour came here in the first week. Is that true of Nibali? Is he somebody who does tend to get stronger as the race goes on?
That is true. It's in the past, he always comes in knowing that the first week's going to be tough for him because his condition's not 100%, and then he rides himself into condition as the tour goes on. The year he lost time on the Muro Bretagna, they went up at once, so it was more an explosive climb, which is not really his kind of finish. Tomorrow they do it twice, so it should be different on paper. It should be different, and the way he raced today gives us confidence that he should be okay. But it is true that he works with his trainer, and we work together, so he comes into the race to increase his form as the race goes along, so he's in top shape in the third week.
So that was Brent Copeland, the general manager at Bahrain Merida. He's always an interesting guy to speak to, and they've been a pretty impressive team this year on numerous fronts.
Colbrelli looks great. I mean, he really, when you consider the big sprinters who haven't won a stage yet or really looked like they might, and you could number Kittel and Cavendish and several others in that, Colbrelli has come very close to winning on two very different finishes, and he's a versatile fellow,
well,
isn't he?
I mean, as Copeland said, he's worked hard to be competitive in finishes like today's, and that's quite a smart move, because if you can lose a bit of weight and retain the speed and the power, that's perhaps his best opportunity to try and beat somebody like Sagan, but Sagan looks almost unbeatable in finishes like that. He is so versatile, and I was watching the finish and watching Sagan in particular. He makes this very, very hard sport look pretty easy at times. He was the only rider among all of them looking around. You could see him looking around, working at where everybody was. Yeah. Alaphilippe was there.
He has an extra gear.
He's a phenomenon. I mean, we're living through, the era of one of the great riders of all time.
Yeah, Francois and I were watching it, and we both had the same reaction at the same moment when we called it, well, Sagan's got it now. And even though Colbrelli was coming up pretty hard and did push him well, it was it's so impressive to see. It looks powerful. It doesn't look smooth and kind of sleek and elegant. There's a kind of a controlled power. Well, I don't want to foreshadow what we're talking about racehorses in the final part, but he has a kind of racehorse, real kind of wide and kind of big frontal area. He's not sleek. He doesn't cut through the wind. He kind of powers through the wind.
He looks
different to all the other riders. He's more muscular, more powerful. He's a proper athlete. As you know,
think of the way a jockey's legs kind of bow around the width of the horse. He looks like that.
When you see him walking around, he has a very strange kind of build. You know, he's not a real athlete. I mean, his legs are really like the legs of a horse. You know, he has that extra horsepower. It's really impressive. Really,
he has huge hands. I
what can we nickname him?
The
French car, the De Cheveux, had the power of two horses. Is that right?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Maybe we should call him the Trois Cheveux.
It's funny that he doesn't have a nickname, isn't it? A rider like that.
It's very astonishing. Yeah.
The Trois Cheveux. The three horses.
You've got a great track record of nicknames, Lionel. let's see what you can come up with.
Can I quickly add a little bit of not, well, kind of French flavor, but a little bit of anecdote that I think is important, because lots of people compare today's stage to a small Liège-Bastogne-Liège, right? And we're in Châteaulin now, discussing the day's stage. Châteaulin was the birthplace of a rider called Camille d'Anguillaume. Camille d'Anguillaume, he belongs to a very, you know, dynasty of riders. They were all, I mean, five or six of them were professional riders. Jean-Pierre d'Anguillaume was the most famous. He won a Tour de France stage in the 70s in La Mongie. But Camille d'Anguillaume won Liège-Bastogne-Liège in 1949, and he was killed in a crash at the French Championship in 1950, the year after. So he's one of these, you know, tragic stories cycling, and I thought that being in Châteaulin, he deserved a homage.
Any relation to Jean-Pierre d'Anguillaume?
Yes, he's his uncle. He was his uncle.
Well, a great Jean-Pierre d'Anguillaume story is that in some race somewhere, I'm sure I've said this on the podcast before, it's a story Sean Yates once told me, and I don't care whether it's true or not because it's an absolute belter, but he was the sports director sportif of the Peugeot team in the early 80s. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the Peugeot riders were displeasing him in a race down in the southwest, the Midi Libre, and so he stopped the car and took the bike off the roof and rode up to the bunch to tell them what to do.
Yeah, the d'Anguillaumes were really a strange breed.
I mean, wonderful. I mean, just what brilliant, a great idea. I mean, can you imagine that happening now? The sports director rides up into the peloton.
Well, just to change the tone completely, at the start this morning in Lorient, I was in the Village Départ and I happened upon David Lapartion, the UCI president.
Oh, from the sublime to the ridiculous.
Well, I wouldn't say that. I first time I've ever spoken to
you. You talk to French mayors.
First time I've ever spoken to David Lapartion.
Were you asking him about the autumn fair in Sarzeau?
I was asking about the roundabouts. President of the UCI and the mayor of Sarzeau, where the stage finished yesterday. Anyway, as we discussed last night in the podcast, he has been having a bit of a ding-dong in the press with Dave Brailsford. The two Daves have been at war, and I just asked him a couple of questions about that. This is part of a longer interview that you'll hear in the next cycling podcast, Femina, actually, because I was asking him a lot about women's racing as well. But here is David Lapartion on his spat with Dave Brailsford, and after that you will hear the final part, the four of us with Daniel Freeb. Sorry, Lionel, you're putting your hand up.
Oh, I need to mention our competition winner from stage one. It's taken 4 days to sort this out.
But
we'll do that at the very end.
Well, we've said our goodbyes already at the very end.
Oh,
so
shall I do it now?
No.
Okay. On stage one, Fernando Gaviria won on his very first day in the Tour de France. And I asked, when was the last time a rider making his Tour de France debut won on his first day, but won in a road stage, not a time trial? Because Cancellara in 2004 won on his first day in the Tour. David Miller did it in 2000. Chris Boardman did it in 1994. And there are others in time trials. But when was the last time a rider won a road stage on their first day in the Tour de France? I didn't know the answer. A couple of people got in touch. Xu Xiaomo, a Chinese fan living in Europe, he and Benedict Aronson both said Edouard Sells, Belgian rider, in 1964. And I look back through the records. It's taken me 3 days to research this. And we're busy on the Tour de France, but it rather punctured my balloon to realise that Killian Kelly, Irish Peloton on Twitter, and really the go-to guy when it comes to stats, he'd already mentioned this on the first day. I'd missed this, but he confirmed that Ward Sells, as he was known, Belgian rider, won in 1964. He won the opening stage. It was his very first day on the Tour de France, and no one had done it since until Gaviria. People who said, oh, Peter Sagan won his first road stage in 2012 and named others, oh, but apart from the prologue, that wasn't the question. So they don't win prizes. But Shu and Benedict will win a prize, which we will sort out after the Tour de France.
Absolutely. Well, let's hear from David Lapartion at the Start Village this morning.
I mean, first of all, a proud day for you yesterday.
Yes, of course. I was very proud to welcome the Tour de France in my city with a wonderful weather, nice stage, and yes, it was wonderful, and the atmosphere was great, and the fans were very happy with that.
Now, you had some comments to make about Dave Brailsford, and relations between you don't seem to be particularly good. Is it a priority of yours to maybe smooth things over a bit there and have a conversation with him at some point?
You know, after the Chris Froome affair and the decision from the UCI, I tried to call all the fans to be quiet, to respect the decision, to respect Chris Froome. I think it was a normal statement from the UCI, and I was not expecting Chris Froome to put some holes on the fire on this. And just he can't believe that I'm not a good president. He can have this opinion. But he cannot tell that I have mentality of a mayor of France, because then it's an insult for all the 35,000 mayors and for the French themselves. So I don't understand what they want to reach with the statement. And he gave me some advice, but I will do what I have to do, and I will not take my order with him. That's for sure. Said that I need to learn. I have to say to tell him that maybe I will need 12 or 16 years to learn.
Do you think, though, that it's healthy for two people who are very influential within the sport to be arguing like this in public? Would you like to maybe sit down with Dave Brailsford and have a conversation with him? Do you think that matters? Is that important?
I don't want to have this kind of. That's why I said that I didn't want to answer, because immediately after the comments, I have a lot of phone calls. I don't want to put polemics on there. I don't want to have polemics with Dave Brailsford. That's not useful for cycling. But the fact is, he said one time, make another time in L'Équipe the day after. So this is something that he wanted to have, you know, to show his muscle. But I will not. I don't know what I have to discuss with him after such a statement. So if you want to ring me, he has, or if you want to sit with me, I have, of course, no problem. But it's up to him for this.
Hey, don't forget. You can listen to Kilometre Zero, our morning show, every weekday during the 2018 Tour de France. Kilometre Zero is supported by Hans Kroh.
A rare sighting of the lesser spotted television's Daniel Freeb. Hello, Daniel.
I'm seeing you all the time. I know,
but we haven't heard you on the podcast yet, this tour.
How's it going? What is this beef about roundabouts? I don't know. I saw
someone's paying attention.
I saw some reference to it on Twitter. I have no idea what it is. It's a bit like the sex shop time trial last year. I feel as though there's a huge void in my life where references to sex shops on the podcast should be.
Well, when you get to catch up with the podcast, you'll learn what it's all about. Daniel, what you've been on the Mark Cavendish beat quite a lot in your TV role.
He's been getting beat quite a lot, hasn't he, unfortunately?
He has. Yeah, we've not spoken to Mark Cavendish yet. We have sort of tried, but what's his current mood?
Okay, I think obviously he came into the tour with, you know, not a lot of racing. He did Slovenia and then the new race in Italy, stage race. So it was always going to be tough for him here, and I think all the sprinters were a bit uncertain about how they measured up against each other. I think he feels there's a lot of pressure on him in the team. The team hasn't had great results this season. We saw Vermont in the break today, and I think, you know, that they are absolutely desperate to get something out of the first part of this tour, because they know that when the mountains come around, they haven't got an awful lot to offer. And you know, things going on behind the scenes, not clear who's, well, whether Cavendish is staying next year, not clear what the sponsorship situation is going to be. Dimension Data are staying on, but we don't know who with. And, all sorts of other things that he's having to contend with. But his spirits are okay. And he seems to think that he's got reasonable fitness anyway, but we haven't really seen it in the last 500 metres of stages yet.
Have you been surprised that Groenewegen was the guy we expect a lot of coming to the tour, that not many of the sprinters, as a lot of them here, are really firing on all cylinders, it seems?
No, I think you're right. And, Sagan and Gaviria have looked by far the fittest of all of them, haven't they? And, it's interesting when you come into a tour and there's no obvious alpha sprinter, there's no sort of lone star that everyone kind of orientates around. And that's the case. That's been the case here, even though Gaviria has won two stages. But Kittel is fully fit. He might get better in 2016. It took him a while to win his first stage. But there aren't many opportunities left, are there? There are a couple before the pavé, and then don't envisage that many sprinters being around by the time we get to... There's a stage in Valence, is there, or Bourg de Valence? And there are very, very few opportunities left.
Any other news, views, scandal, speculation, rumour?
I spent a long time this morning reading about Warren Barguil's passion for Lorient Football Club. Les Merlus.
You know, my nickname is Merlin, that's cod. Les Merlus, it's almost the same fish, so I should be supporting Les Merlus.
You ate one last night.
Yeah, I did, yeah. It was quite good, actually. I can't remember the taste of it because I was watching a football match. I don't want to mention it. We said we wouldn't mention football.
Hake, isn't it, Merlu? Hake, no?
Hake, yeah. Yeah.
It says Hake.
And they play in orange. And
Are they a whimsical football team?
Probably. He's been quite whimsical so far. Was Barguil the rider? I tried to establish this yesterday without success, but there was a Fortuneo rider who went off the road almost at right angles, up a hill, down a ditch.
I don't think it was Barguil.
Behind the back
of some daisies there.
Behind the back of a burger van and returned with an armful of daisies, of dandelions.
Really?
And wearing a straw boater.
Really?
Is that him?
This all happened.
If you study the footage, there is a Fortuneo rider who did an extraordinary slalom off the route.
I was watching with you at the time, Daniel, and he did. He went off road and he was trying to get back on the road. He did take a very long route round, past some caravans.
He was Elie Gesbert. I'm pretty confident he was. Yeah. You know, the guy who set fire to his bedroom last year.
He was born in 1995, on the day that the tour began in his hometown in 1995.
He's also got a fantastically literary name. You can imagine him, you know, being a contemporary of Marcel Proust or Albert Camus, can't you?
Poor Lionel.
Well, I was just going to just add on Lorient Football Club. Watford played Lorient in a pre-season friendly a few years ago, and Lorient ended up getting relegated at the end of that season. Not sure what that says. I don't think Warren Barguil was at the match, though, because it was in Watford.
And they play in a kit that's very similar to the kit worn by, or the silks. I'm out of my comfort zone. I'm talking about horse racing now. The silks worn by the jockey, but of Sylvain Chavanel's racehorse called Fleur Douan.
But
is that how it works in horse racing? The jockey of a particular horse always wears the same gear.
It's not the jockey, the breeder actually. When you own horses, I know because I owned horses at one stage in my life. Not a full horse on the left leg, you know, something.
You own the rump, Francois.
but it's true that when you own horses, you have your own colours, and they're always the same when they race.
Well, Sylvain Chavanel's colours are orange with a thick black stripe down the middle, and Lorient playing
Sylvain Chavanel or Warren Barguil.
No, I'm talking about Sylvain Chavanel now.
He was
in the break today.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
Talking of kit, so Francois and I were just saying how good it would be if their cycling team had a Croatia-style jersey, checkerboard. But of course, it just come to me, Boa Vista, the Portuguese team, when they play in black and play in black, they play cycling in black and white Czechs, don't they?
The Czechs belong to the history of cycling as being the Peugeot, you know, jersey, and it's so iconic that I don't think anybody these days would try to emulate that.
This is taking a really surreal turn.
It's taking a very Bargillian turn, hasn't it?
Let's talk about fishing now, shall we? Anyway, we should let you go, Daniel.
You'd have a good fishing story.
Oh God.
I honestly did, and I can't remember what it was. Anyway.
I have a good one, a fishing story, but it'll take us maybe to something we're going to discuss at another stage of today's episode. But, you know, Quimper and fish are kind of linked in the history of cycling, because remember 1991, the PDM story. 1962, you had also a team who were intoxicated by fish in Brittany. So and remember, PDM was in Quimper actually. That the whole team was kind of was forced to withdraw with problems. They didn't blame fish; they blamed orange juice or the menu they had in a hotel in Rennes. But but all the PDM. Massive, mass suicide, I was about to say, mass withdrawal happened in Quimper.
It was later revealed that it was intralipid, which was a kind of a liquid nutrient, which wasn't...
Odd way to consume fish.
It wasn't fish-flavoured liquid nutrient, but it was intravenously administered, and there was obviously a bad batch. Either the fridge had gone off or it got too warm. Just on that...
It was a fishy episode.
It was a very fishy episode, but what I do know is that the... So this was a big scandal because PDM was a huge team. They were all sick as dogs the next day, couldn't carry on with the tour. They all pulled out en masse ill. And there was a whole discussion about what were they going to say and what were they going to do. And the odd kind of honour and code of honour amongst cyclists, it was put to them by the team, well, we're going to blame the restaurant and say that it was food poisoning. Yeah. And the rider said, no, that's not fair on the hotel and so on.
On the day I was there at the hotel when it was all revealed here in Quimper, and they blamed orange juice at first.
More oranges. all of these strands are going to meet in a minute with the revelation that Michael Matthews left the Tour de France today as a result of some dodgy hake that he ate last night, and he was taken away in a Sunweb chariot ridden by Sylvain Chavanel's jockey of choice.
Yeah, in an orange, car, because they're sponsors of the tour as well.
People are going to start thinking we've been stood out in the blazing sun all day and it's gone to our heads.
I mean, intravenous stuff that is obviously...
Okay, let's wrap things up. Let's wrap things up. We've got to go and watch a football match. Daniel, lovely to see you. See you again soon.
Lovely to see you, yeah.
Thanks, Daniel. Thanks, Lionel.
Thank you.
Thanks, Francois.
Thanks.
You have been listening to the Cycling Podcast at the 2018 Tour de France. Thanks to our sponsors, Rafa and Science in Sport. The music is by Santoré.